You get so comfortable. I was sitting back during the announcements. I began to yawn, and then slowly, you know, but surely my mind began to wander. But it's nice anyway and comfortable. Some of the halls we've met in from time to time in different areas, you couldn't go to sleep if you'd wanted to. We had a hall in Uniontown, Pennsylvania, where I was for about 6 years over in that area toward Pittsburgh, and you couldn't go to sleep. Every other week they had a wedding. And they would be fixing, it was a German-Polish environment, and you'd smell sauerkraut. Have you ever tried to go to sleep smelling sauerkraut? And it makes it very, very difficult, to say the least. You have to forgive me if I'm a little helter-skelter. I am on vacation. And I called Mr. Pyle, and we talked a while, and he said, would you speak? And by the time I got around to answering, he had to do something else and hung up. You'll hear a different story from him. I do want to cover something that maybe give you a little insight into, say, an area of life you haven't thought about, or maybe you've pondered it and haven't come to a conclusion on it. How many of you were in religions like the Methodist, Baptist, Pentecostal years ago? Many of you? Almost of you. You know, just a normal mainstream of religion. I grew up in the Methodist church, but we sort of, my parents did, dabbled in a little bit of everything. We went to Pentecostal churches. I remember going to Billy Graham's campaigns when he just got started. And I remember going to Oral Roberts when he was still in the healing business. Now, he's been out of that for 20 years. But when he still did that. And growing up, I got the direct impression from religion, from the Methodist where I was in the South, which was basically more evangelical, and from the Baptist, which my mother attended from time to time, and from all the various camp meetings, tent meetings, and all that we went to, I got the impression that God was in the business now of giving you just about everything you wanted. I remember thinking growing up, now maybe you haven't thought this, but I would want something, and I would think from my religious background, now if I ask God for it, maybe he'll give it. I remember I worked at a radio station after high school for a little while, and we had a group to come on there on Sundays, on FM. And if you ever listen to Sunday FM in the South, you'll know what I'm talking about. They're different. And they would jump up and down. In fact, they jumped over one of our chairs and broke it because they didn't quite make it. And that was on the air. Now, what happened? This fellow was healing people. And he had this kid that had been healed of not wearing his eyesight. He had poor eyesight, and he was healed of the poor eyesight. Threw away his glasses. And he had asked God now to give him good sight. Well, the kid could not even find the microphone. They led him up there, and he announced that he had been healed. And I sat there, and I looked out there, and I said, that's strange now. They think God is giving them everything they want, and yet he didn't. Now, what if God gave you everything you wanted? What if he did? By even phrasing the question like I do, I'm saying if, which is automatically prejudicing you or giving you my opinion that he doesn't. But what if he did? Are there any case histories of God doing that? Giving somebody or a group of people just about everything they want and what happened to them? And how about in the New Testament? Does God do that? Turn back to the example of the Israelites back in Exodus chapter 3. And let's take a look at ancient Israel and begin to find out what happened when God gave a whole group of people just about everything you could want. And then we'll take a look at maybe some data that people have collected today in just a human physical sense. And then look at the New Testament and find out what God does do and what he does give us. Exodus chapter 3. This is the example of the Israelites, and I could go through all kinds of phrases with them. But in Exodus 3, and going into about, I can give you the story to break into it. Remember the case of Moses keeping his flock, and finally he came upon God, the burning bush, and that's verses 1 through about 9. And God began to tell Moses what he had in mind. Look what he said in verse 7. And the Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people which are in Egypt. Now what God was saying is, I've seen that my people are in bondage. They are in slavery. These people are suffering. Now, we look at it and we think, boy, we're in bondage. We're in bondage to Bank AmeriCard, bondage to MasterCharge, bondage to car payments and house payments. Listen, these people were in such bondage, if they didn't perform right, they were killed. You know, it's the kind of bondage you've very seldom seen in modern history, except maybe in some sections of Africa and India and perhaps China, of recent dates in Asia. But they were going to be killed. God looked at that bondage. Now, what would you think would be the greatest gift you could give somebody if they were in absolute slavery, where their firstborn were being killed? Now, that is bondage, where you had a little baby and you were scared to death if that baby were going to be a little boy, he was going to be killed. And all the, can you imagine the pressure on a woman as she became pregnant, as she began to go through the normal gestation period on up, say, 7-8 months? Instead of being happy we're going to have a little baby, you'd be scared to death. I'm going to have a baby, and if it's a boy, and you don't have any control over it, a little X and Y chromosome got together, and there's a boy instead of an XX, and you would say, my, here, what's happening? And the traumas that came about as a result of that, God heard that. He could relate to it. He understood it. And what did he give the Israelites? He began to tell Moses what he would give them. He said, I've seen the affliction, and then the latter part of verse 7, and have heard their cry by reason of their taskmasters, who beat them, who were merciless, who worked them to death, who used them evidently to build all the pyramids and a lot of the things you can see in Egypt, for I have known their sorrows. And I am come down to deliver them, verse 8, out of the hand of the Egyptians, and to bring them out of the land unto. God said, I'm going to give them freedom, and here's what else I'm going to give them. This is what you would like. It's better than my garden, which doesn't produce this. He said, I'm going to give them a land that is good and large, into a land of flowing with milk and honey, and into a place of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, and all these otherites. He said, I'm going to give them a land that would make your eyes pop out. Now, that was something he gave them. Now, you would think, now, once, what if somebody came up and offered you the most beautiful home that your expectations could employ? Now, you dreamed about it. Boy, I want a dishwasher that, I mean, you can push a button and it jerks the dishes off the table. You know, it's funny how we do things. Years ago, if you had a dishwasher, it was a sign of laziness. Now, it's one with more buttons on it. And then, you know, I even find we start complaining we're in a hurry. Well, the dishes have to be taken off the table and the scraps put off from them to stick them in the dishwasher. Now, maybe some of you married a dishwasher and haven't traded it in for one of the modern types, if you can use that expression, since then. But still, we tend to expect all of these things. Well, the Israelites were given their expectations, their own land. They were given freedom. And not only that, you can go through a list of things that they were given that would absolutely be marvelous. If we could have it. Look at Exodus 14. In this country today, we spend over $100 billion a year for protection. McDonnell Douglas out here in St. Louis produces quite a bit of income for the area because they produce basically, well, not only the DC-10 anymore, but military aircraft. And a big expenditure in this country is for protection. We spend more for protection than just about anything else. Now, God gave the Israelites protection that you couldn't beat, and it was free of charge. Now, that's something that if you wanted it as a big thing, I mean, you're not only promising them the greatest land to farm and a place to live, he said, I will protect you till you get there. They didn't have to have policemen. They didn't have to have all the military armaments we have. He said, I'll take care of you. And Exodus 14 is an example of that. After Pharaoh's heart was hardened, and I'll paraphrase it and then just pick up a couple of verses, he began to have second thoughts. Now, you have second thoughts about things. Have you ever been scared of something or afraid at the time, and then maybe 3 weeks later you reflect back on it, or a little while later and you're not quite as afraid of it? Boy, I should have gone ahead and done that. It's like little children. Our little boys take swimming lessons, and they eternally, you know, when they're on a high dive, one of them, or on a diving board, I won't do it. Then when he's home, boy, I'll do that. It's like our little girl. We have a little girl, 28 and a half months old. She said, I'm going to ride a horse. I ride horse. We took her up to a horse. She would say she would ride that horse, but the closer she got to the horse, the less she would want to ride it. And when she got up next to it, she started not only not wanting, she started reacting to it, crying, hollering. Then you would take her back in the house. I ride the horse. Now what happened? She had second thoughts the further she got away from the problem. The horse was the problem. They've even tested rats and found that out. They'll take a rat and they'll starve him almost to death, and they'll put food at one end of the cage and make him run to the food. Well, the rat loves that. He does it once. Second time, they shock him. He can get his food, but they shock him to get it. Well, that old rat gets smart fast. I mean, the third time, he takes off for the food, and then he sort of slows down a little bit as he gets near it. After just a few runs at that, you know what he does? He gets about a certain distance that you can predict for all rats. He gets there, and he turns over, and he begins to do all kinds of unseemly things, lick himself and shake. You see, he's getting close to that shock, and he wants the food. As long as God was punishing Pharaoh, Pharaoh felt about the same way. Because right there was the immediate punishment. He just stopped. The Israelites left and got away from him. He thought, I'll get them. Well, he took off after them. He tried to get them. Here he came thundering down. Well, the Israelites looked back. Now, God had not been performing any direct miracles for a day or so. About a day. And they began to get worried. Verse 11. And they said to Moses in chapter 14 of Exodus, because there were no graves in Egypt, a highly optimistic attitude. You know, what they were saying is, we're going to die. You ever met people like that? If they get a cough, they're going to die. There's something that's wrong with them. Everything is death. All right, the Israelites didn't say, now, hey, we might be able to escape. They said, hey, we're dead. In fact, they weren't only dead, they were talking about the grave and being under and all. When you start talking about the grave, if you get people talking about that, it's a very morbid thought. And not only that, you're being preoccupied with being put under. It's not only you're dead, you're under now. And very fearful people. It's a very fearful kind of thinking. They said, now why have you taken us away to die in the wilderness? Wherefore have you dealt with us to carry us forth out of Egypt? Now, all kinds of questions began. Based on the premise they were going to die, they began to ask other questions. That was a wrong premise. They weren't going to die. But based on that idea, their reasoning was right. Why do we have to die out here? I'd rather have died a few years later in Egypt. Now, they began to talk about that. And then verse 12, is not this the word that we did tell you in Egypt? You know, it's the old story. Didn't I tell you before I didn't want to come out here? This is what the leaders were telling Moses. I didn't want to get involved in this, Moses. Here we're going to die. All these people die. Why didn't you leave us alone? For it had been better for us to serve the Egyptians than we should die in the wilderness. Now, at that juncture, what would be the greatest gift you could give the Israelites? You know, the greatest gift you could give them? Life. It'd be like taking someone who thinks he's going to die, who knows he's going to die because he's sick, and giving him health. You know, that would make you feel good. Have you ever been sick and gotten well? You know, had the flu and been sick as a dog, use a vernacular statement, and all of a sudden you got well. You jumped out of bed and you thought, oh, man, I feel great. And you know, it's an elated spirit. You just feel real good all over. All right, the Israelites began or were going to experience that. They were afraid. They were going to die. They were shaking. You can imagine the children started crying. The mothers were upset. And it's like a disease or infection that spreads. Now, Moses said in verse 13, and Moses said unto the people, fear you not, stand still. And see the salvation of the Lord, which he will show you today. For the Egyptians, whom you have seen this day, or today, you shall see them again, no more, forever. God will fight for you, or the Lord shall fight for you, and you shall hold your peace. Now, what he told them, and it happened, is they won't kill you, and God will protect you. And they witnessed an event that was miraculous. And I think the Ten Commandments probably wouldn't do it justice, because if you walked through a sea and saw all of the billowing waters above you and went through that and got on the other side and then saw this army pursuing you and saw the water collapse on them, then began seeing chariots float up on the top of the water and all of that, that would be something that would really, I don't think we could explain that in our terms. We haven't experienced it. You would look and look at all the horrible experiences of people who had abused you and your family for years. And all of a sudden, you didn't do anything. They're no more a factor in your life. God gave them protection, dramatic protection. Now, not only that, look at Exodus 16, verse 4. You know, today we have the food stamp program. We give people all kinds of food stamps, which frankly keeps the American farmer in business, the commodity market, the canneries, because you can buy American food, so it's sort of hard to say what we give away. Take it from one, give it to another, and then the farmer gets the money, the commodity people, and then they spend it on airplanes, tractors, and fertilizer to keep somebody else working. So it's a big circle in society. Well, God dealt with the Israelites in a way that was unique. Here they were out in the wilderness, and God began to give them something that's very important. Look at verse 4. Then said the Lord unto Moses, Behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you. Now that is great. God gave the Israelites free food. They didn't have to go to Safeway, Kroger's, any of these stores. I mean, it was there. They didn't have to read labels for it. It was made by God. They didn't have to check, wonder if any vitamins are in this. Wonder if they processed it too much. They didn't worry about it. I mean, God made it. They were given their food free. Did not have to plow for it, because it's hard to plow rocks and sand in the desert anyway. They didn't have to worry about it. It was there. He began seeing what the Israelites were given as a totality of this tangible items. They were given freedom, protection, and food. You know, a lot of that's what you worry about. I worry about protection. Somebody's going to break in my house. I'm scared. Lock my car doors. You go downtown, you're afraid somebody may vandalize you. In Memphis, some guy was driving around the downtown area with his doors unlocked, and two women jumped in the car and stabbed him. And I read that, and I go downtown, I'm locking my door and looking out, and boy, these women, I'm going to, you know, take off the other way. We live in that kind of fear. God gave them protection. The other thing you worry about is buying food and keeping your family fed and all of this. God gave them men. Look at Exodus 17, another example. Exodus 17, verse 1. And you can read the whole example here, because this is the example of where the people didn't have any water. Now today, we cannot really feel like they felt. We live in cities where we turn on the tap and water is equated with a bill and money. If you've got money, you can get water. Today, we probably, if we were out in the desert, we would be arguing because there's no Coke, no beer. We would be complaining, God, I mean, where's the pop? Don't have any iced tea. Don't have any pop. Don't have any of this. All right, well, they were complaining they didn't have any water, which is far more essential. They were, you know, out in the middle of the desert, they're going to die. And again, that panic took over. People began to murmur in verse 3 against Moses. You know, Moses, if you think for a moment, what could he do as a physical human being? He couldn't do anything. He couldn't make water. And you're talking about the position it put him in, and the realization there'd better be a God there, and God to come through for him, did a great deal for Moses in helping him. All right, here they wanted water. And you remember the example that Moses smote the stone, and water like a river just came out. All the people had plenty to drink. So God gave them water. You can go through example after example. Just Exodus chapter 20. If you want to take a religious issue, people today, more than anything else, I think in religions, would like for God to talk with them. You ever notice that? How many people say, God spoke to me? A lady about 100 years ago fell over backwards. God spoke to her, and she started a whole religion out of that. And have you ever heard people, I remember in Ohio, visiting a lady where Christ would come in at night and stand at the foot of her bed and talk with her. She said, and I think she believed it. Now, I didn't believe it, but she did. Now, what happens, though? How would you like God to talk with you? That would be something I think we'd want. All right, Exodus 20 is an example of God sitting down or standing up, whatever, it doesn't say what he was doing, but talking with man, giving man essential principles of how a community must be conducted to exist. Or to use fancy words, maybe put it simply, he gave them laws that if they didn't keep, their whole society would go kaput. Their home life would shatter. And they would be dealing in crime and frustration and problems, just on a human plane. He gave them those laws. He talked to them. And as you begin to see the Israelites, God gave them freedom, he gave them protection, he gave them food, he gave them water, he spoke to them. And in Exodus 40, you'll find he even traveled with them. Well, that's powerful. I mean, he went with them. He traveled all the time. Was there in a cloud with them. Now, you would think that after that experience, the Israelites would know God better than anybody else. They would understand God. They'd been given a lot. Look at Deuteronomy 5. And did they really benefit in a spiritual way from all that had been given? Deuteronomy 5, verse 29. As God reflected in his own opinion, or in his opinion, shows exactly what he thought. Deuteronomy 5, verse 29. And he said, "Oh, that there were such a heart in them that they would fear me and keep my commandments always, that it might be well with them and with their children forever." Well, that's strange. God says, I wish they had the heart, the mind, to really understand what I'm driving at. But they didn't. Because they'd get the manna, they'd eat it for a few years, and I don't know whether God changed the flavor of it. He didn't say. But they got tired of it. And they didn't like God then. They sort of got upset with him. They took out their frustrations on Moses, though. They were scared to get mad at God personally because they knew what he had done to Pharaoh. They knew what he did to the army. So they get mad at Moses instead. It's always easy to get mad with a human being. Nobody likes to get mad with God because there's the outside chance you could die. And then, he can get you. You read the Bible. He can do you in then. So most people will take it out on the human being first. So they would tell Moses off. They called him every name in the book. They got mad at him because, Moses, you're our problem. God, he's not our problem. Our problems are because of you. And this has always been true of human beings. We displace our anger on other people and take it out on them because we don't want to make God mad. All right, here God says, though, they didn't get the point. They really didn't understand. So what if God gave a nation, just on a human level, everything they really needed or could want in one sense, what would happen to them? They still wouldn't have the mind that God wants to develop in man. They would have food. They would have a lot of things, but they may not, in all of that, have the mind that God wants. They wouldn't think like God. They wouldn't understand like God. Let me give you an example from a textbook of what people viewing human behavior say about parents as a human model or example, about parents who are over-permissive and indulgent. Now, God is a parent. And just when I read this, think a little bit about what if God acted like these parents, over-indulgent. Indulgent means every time a kid whimpers, you give him something. He cries in the store, you plug in the sucker he wants. He cries in Kmart, you give him a toy. He cries at home, you give him what he wants. And you've seen parents like that, haven't you? You've gone through the store, a little kid, the kid go, and they'll say, shut up, quiet. He go, quiet. And the louder the kid gets, the mother gets panicky. You've seen it and say, here it is. Kid, sits there and happy as all get out. That kid has built a habit then. He knows the louder he cries, you'll give it to him. That's what we call indulgence, or what can be phrased indulgence. Let me read what over-permissiveness and indulgence does. Then I'll give you a classic example of what happens when somebody has been overindulged. It said, although it happens less commonly than is popularly supposed, sometimes one or both parents cater to a child's slightest whims, and in doing so, fail to teach and reward desirable standards of behavior. Those are big words. Say, you give him something, and every time he whines, you give it to him, and you really reward crying and whimpering and, make it desirable for him to do it. In essence, the parent surrenders the running of the home to the uninhibited son or daughter. A fellow in 1968 by Pollock gave an example, and he quoted a father who had been very permissive with his little 9-year-old daughter. And finally, here's what happened. The permissive father finally rebelled in tyranny against his 9-year-old daughter, and in a near tantrum exploded. This is a father to his little 9-year-old daughter. He said, I want one thing perfectly clear and understood. I live in this house too. I'd tell the little girl. So he had given her everything, so he had to tell the girl, I exist. I'm bigger than you, and I live here, so I have rights. Overly indulged children are characteristically spoiled, selfish, inconsiderate, and demanding. A fellow from the University of California at Berkeley in 1961 found a high permissiveness and low punishment in the home were correlated with antisocial, aggressive behavior. I mean, the kid just, you know, was unruly, particularly during middle and late childhood. Unlike rejected, emotionally deprived children who often find it difficult to enter into a warm interpersonal relationship, indulged children enter readily into such relationships. In other words, they get along with people and they just seem friendly, but then they exploit people for their own purposes, in the same way that they have learned to exploit their parents. In dealing with authority, such children are usually rebellious since for so long they have had their own way. Every time they wanted something, they were given it. Overly indulged children also tend to be impatient. Now read the example of the Israelites. They got impatient. They didn't get water, boom. They didn't get this, they blew up. Impatient. They tend to approach problems in an aggressive and demanding manner, and to find it difficult to accept present frustrations in the interest of long-range goals. And then what really fakes them out is when they get into the real world, they find life does not allow them the privilege of getting everything immediately. They go in debt, they marry speedily in a hurry to get somebody, and they live that kind of life of frustration. A classic example of somebody who lived that way and was overindulged is a fellow called Dear Marshal Hermann Göring over in the Nazi regime. And let me read you a little bit about Göring. Göring had a better family background than most of his Nazi associates. Here the fellow had been, he grew up in a pretty rich environment, been given a lot. His father had been governor of German Southwest Africa and resident minister of Haiti. Hermann attended several boarding schools but was bored and restless till he got to the military academy where he settled down to his studies. So Hermann Göring. Now, Göring was given a lot in his life. And notice what it did to him. And then we'll go into the New Testament and find out what God, when he gives you something, how you ought to really entertain it and use it. He entered the army as an infantryman, but he took flying lessons surreptitiously and got himself transferred to the Air Force against the wishes of his superior officers. Because, you know, flying an airplane is easier than shooting a gun and hiking around in the army. Anybody knows that. I fly. I mean, I can fly over a whole... I remember we used to go hunting up in the Monongahela National Forest in West Virginia. Mountain is one peak, 5,000 feet. And I mean, it would really tough you out to hike up the mountain. I went over there in an airplane to scout that area, flying around one day. And I mean, I could go up and down any place I wanted, no problem. Hermann Göring figured that out about 40 years ago. So anyway, or 50, I guess. He was in World War I. So what he did, he got in the Air Force. He was courageous and an impetuous flyer, and after the death of Richthofen, he took charge of the flying circus. At the close of the First World War, Göring went to Sweden, where he worked as a mechanic and as a civil aviator. Not to be outfoxed, he married a wealthy woman. I wonder why he married a wealthy woman. All right, Hermann married a wealthy woman and enrolled in the University of Munich. In Munich, he met Hitler and joined the Nazi movement. Göring's manner of living is described as Byzantine splendor. That means rich. And as a particular, pirate-tanical splendor, lived like a pirate. I mean, he just lived, he ate, and he had a big time, lived in a beautiful home, a castle. He built a pretentious country home near Berlin and furnished it magnificently with tapestries, paintings, and antiques. He had his own private zoo. He required his servants to address his wife by nobility and in a term of nobility, thus giving her the distinction of nobility. He felt that the Germans liked his display of luxury, and he bragged about it. He gave food for their imagination and gave the people something to think about. Dear Göring, I mean, he began getting things, and the more he got, the more he became mentally a little bit difficult to live with. Göring was given to exhibitionism and had a passion for uniforms, gold braids, medals, decorations. Göring would strut and swagger in private and in public. In political rallies, he made himself a flamboyant master of pomp and pageantry. He was an exhibitionist in the psychopathic pattern. Big word, he was just crazy when you get down to it. Goring was coarse, however, and gross. He was a gargantuan eater and drinker. He was ribald in jest. He laughed uproariously when his pet lion had an accident on a lady's dress. He horrified men and women by having a bull and a cow mate before them. He said he personally enjoyed the spectacle and declared it was an old Teutonic custom. See, when they really didn't like it, what he did, he said, this is really an old German custom. He gave historical credence to his behavior. Our Hermann was popular with the masses, and they smiled good-naturedly at his antics and self-display. He demanded they make sacrifices in order to win World War II in victory. He exhorted them to choose guns instead of butter. He patted his fat belly. If you've ever seen pictures of Goring, you know, can appreciate this. He patted his fat belly and said that he had lost 40 pounds in the service of his country. The Germans appreciated his sense of humor. Goring was unscrupulous in his exercise of authority. He was said to be courageous, hard, challenging, and authoritative in the pure Prussian manner. He was described as affable and a hearty butcher. When he was made chief of the Prussian police, he told his men to shoot first and inquire afterwards. He said, if you make a mistake, don't talk about it. The faults which my officials commit are my faults. The bullets they fire are my bullets. Goring regarded his bullets as an effective form of propaganda. He introduced the concentration camps and declared that it was not his duty to exercise justice, but to annihilate and to exterminate. Pampered, see, everything, he had no conscience after a while. He was given everything he wanted, and he began to demand more. He did not look on human life as valuable, and was a part author and propitiator of the concentration camps. He introduced decapitation. Guess how he explained that? He explained it as an honest old German punishment. Made it nationalistic. Goring is given credit for plotting the Reichstag fire and planning the direction of the blood purge. Goring admitted that he had no conscience, and his conscience was Adolf Hitler. Like many a sociopath, Goring had a tender side. He was fond of animals, including his lion cubs. He declared that he who torments an animal hurts the feeling of the whole German people, and at the same time would kill the masses and the Jews and all kinds of other things that he did. Goring was often considered the most natural and most conservative of the Nazi leaders. Like most people in his ilk of mental condition, he would appear normal in his social relationships, and he might seem genial and kindly with humor. However, he wasn't that way. Well, what happens, though, if you're given everything you want before you're ready to know what to do with it? You can become very selfish, very materialistic, and very spoiled. And the Israelites did not have the mind to accept everything God had given them. Now turn to Matthew chapter 6. Matthew 6. Let's look at a few things here. Matthew chapter 6. And notice what Jesus Christ said. It's showing how he was going to deal with people. This is almost, in Matthew 5, 6, and 7, a platform speech of how God thinks and how he puts things together and what he was going to require of New Testament Christians to do in addition to just keeping the laws. This is the kind of mind he wanted to build. An addition added to what the Israelites were ever given. And a big addition at that. Or, as it said in Matthew 5:17, it was a magnification of what they were given. To show the intent, what God had in mind, how he thought. I said in verse 19 of Matthew 6, lay not up for yourselves treasures upon earth, for moth and rust does corrupt. Now, what kind of treasures does moth and dust corrupt? All the little treasures we buy. You ever bought a new car and looked at it about 3 years later and found rust on it? You know, look at it and you sort of think, boy, this was pretty at one time. It's rusty now. We bought our children bicycles. And I go out and look at those bicycles a year and a half later, and they look like they went through the First World War, Second World War, Korea, Vietnam, and are now probably down in Africa fighting some war there. See, they rusted. Now, what he's showing, he's not saying it's wrong to have treasures on earth. What he's saying, as we go through this, it's the idea people tend to emphasize certain kinds, and we all do, of treasures. And then I want to get into another point as we go through this. He said, these treasures, to identify them, to label them, are treasures that can corrupt. They can rust. And not only that, they're treasures that can be stolen. Somebody can take them from you. People can take your houses. My grandfather, or great-grandfather, had farms down in South Carolina, cotton farms, back at the turn of the century. And I mean, every time, my granddad used to tell me, you know, we'd sit around a stove and he'd relate all the stories. But what would happen as cotton prices went down because of Egyptian exports back in the late 1800s, early 1900s, my great-grandfather would lose a farm. Take him 2 years of Egyptian cotton coming into this country, and the bank would repossess his farm. Then it'd take him about 2 years to get it back. Then about 3 or 4 years later, here would come more Egyptian cotton, the bank would get his farm again. It was a big cycle. So finally, they moved to North Carolina and got out of the whole thing and quit raising cotton. My grandfather did. My great-grandfather never left. He kept in that cycle. All right, what happened, though? People could break in and take it. Now, what Christ says, though, in verse 20, he said the emphasis ought to be in your life. He said most people just emphasize one aspect, all the physical things that we can garner and get to ourselves and bring in. He said, but lay up for yourselves treasure in heaven. Now, how do you lay up treasures in heaven? Now, obviously, you can't buy them. Because anything you can buy tangibly, somebody can take it away from you. He said, where neither moth nor rust does corrupt, and where thieves do not break in, or break through, nor steal. Then he says in verse 21, for where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. That's a strange thing in modern society. We equate things probably differently than they would have back 2,000 years ago. Because we live in a society, our treasures are in dollars and cents. My little boy saw a $100 bill. And boy, he thought that was something. He said, I want that. Problem was, I wanted it too. And he looked at that, and his eyes got big, and he wanted to hold it. He said, I want to put it in my pocket. Now, he really wasn't intent on the $100 bill per se, because after a while, his little mind, you could begin to see, he talked about bicycles. The money wasn't a treasure. What the money would buy was really a treasure. Have you ever noticed that? The money itself is not the greatest treasure. It's what it'll buy and purchase that gets to be a treasure to you. Now, you go out and I go out. I take my wallet and I think, boy, I am going to buy. And I take my dollars and cents, and I don't worship those. I think about what I'm going to buy, and I talk about it. I went out, and I had seen this commercial on television about Weed Eater. You seen the Weed Eater commercial? I thought, boy, that is what I want. I can edge, I can cut, I can do everything. Probably give my kids a haircut with it, the way the thing works. I thought, that is the greatest thing in the world. I borrowed somebody, and I liked it. Hey, listen, I thought that was great. So I went out and bought one. Now, what was my treasure, though? My treasure is not a Weed Eater, it's a Weed Whacker. My same thing, though. My Weed Whacker was a treasure. I went out, and I mean, the other Friday, I used that thing 2-3 hours. I went out and by a fence, cut out all the weeds, edged, and I thought about it and talked about it. Now, if you look at a fisherman, and you go out and say, now, where's your treasure? It's not the money he has, it's what that money does that becomes a treasure. He says, boy, my treasure, let me show you this rod and reel. I got this, and I can show you the greatest plug that is ever invented. Paid $9.95 for it to catch anything. And then he uses it a few times, and you go back a year later, and he's got a new one that'll do anything. And then he's got next year another one that'll do anything. All right, the treasure is what you buy. You know, I have a lot of treasures that moth and corruption bother. I have a house. I have a car. My wife's little Toyota. Moth and corruption does bother it from time to time. And all of that. But when you use your money, you begin to think about it. See, Christ made a very emphatic statement that is so true. Once you invest your treasure in a home, you think about it, you talk about it, you're absorbed with it. I don't care what you buy. We have gone through a cycle. I don't know how you are. But every time we buy things, you know, a crock pot's going to solve all your problems. You just throw stuff in it, walk off, come back a month later, and the food's done. Never burn anything. You know, you buy it. And that's your treasure for while you invest, what, $9.95, $16.95 in it, solve all your problems. Well, it's a treasure for a while, and you talk about it. Friends come over and you say, hey, I want to show you my crock pot, or you feed them stuff out of the crock pot. Isn't this good? You know, they sit there and eat it, and they're good. I'm not downing crock pots. But what the money does, it begins to show, and it begins to reflect something that's important to you, and you use it. Or you can go through the electric knives. And I remember we had some old washing machines that I thought we bought up in Canada, I think, for $5 a piece. And my wife said, we've got to have something better. I mean, they burn double knits, and they break, and we had babies coming along. And we thought, well, we'll finally, and after, I guess, we were married 7, 8 years, we finally saved enough money to buy a washer and dryer. We thought that was great, to go with our $5 refrigerator and $25 stove. And anyway, we bought the washing machines. And you know those things, where they were the apple of our eye. I even used them. I'd go down there and, you know, you just push buttons and throw stuff in. Great. And we talked about it. People would come to our house, I want to show you our washing machine. You ever visit anybody and they do show you things like that? Sure you do. They've invested their money, and that's where their mind is. That's what they're thinking about. Guy gets a new boat. Hey, I want to show you my new boat. And I mean, you may be sick of boats, but he's going to show you and he'll tell you everything about it, and he'll try to convince you why it was the best buy. That's not wrong. But what it's doing is reflecting that's where your treasure is. That's what you think about. It's true with tithing. It's true with giving. It's true with anything. If you give something, you ought to think about it. When you start giving and don't think you're a part of something, you've got problems. If I made mortgage payments on my house and I thought they were stealing my house away from me or something was happening to it, I'd be fearful. And all of these things come up in our minds. And where your treasure is, that's where your heart is. And this is true with all of us. Now, Christ was emphasizing there are treasures you can build in your life that are even more important than the physical treasures. And he was showing as part of the attitude of giving, the attitude of service, and all of the things he begins to talk about in this chapter. He says in verse 22, the light of the body is the eye. If your eye be single, your whole body shall be full of light. But if your eye be evil, your whole body shall be full of darkness. And he's showing these contrasts of treasures on the earth versus a kind of treasure that Christ wanted to build in humankind. Something that hadn't been built in the Israelites, a mind that hadn't been developed in them. And he was showing that most people live life in a darkened state. They don't get the point of what God is talking about. He says in verse 24, no man can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one or love the other, or else he will hold to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. He's not saying it's wrong to have mammon. He says serve it, for that is the major emphasis in your life. I'll take a classic example. We have men like former President Nixon. I don't know how much you've read about him or read the Watergate papers and all of that, but here was a man who wanted to be president. He really wanted to be. But he was willing to make sacrifices that shouldn't have been made to maintain what his illusion of a president was. He was willing to sacrifice things like honesty. He was willing to sacrifice things like integrity. He was willing to sacrifice things like his language about other people, his attitudes about other people, like calling Mr. Mitchell the big enchilada, which I expect Mr. Mitchell didn't like. This was on one of the tapes. I read every one of those silly things. And you're talking about disillusion with what went on and the attitude behind it. What he was willing to sacrifice was what we call basic human traits of honesty and goodness in order to be president. Now, if you were to talk with him now, I don't know whether he would want to sacrifice those things. He said, I wish I would have done this a little differently. See, this is the emphasis we're talking about. There have been people to sacrifice their entire lives for something physical and sacrifice their integrity, truthfulness, all of these things. That's what Christ is getting at. You found yourself in that position. I have, where I need something, and boy, if I just run that stop sign, I can get there. And, you know, not that, you know, there may be cases where you ought to run a stop sign. There have been cases where I've run, you know, gone through an intersection, and after I got through it, asked myself, did I stop? And not known. Hey, you're tired of something. Remember years ago, you know, when driving 60,000 miles a year, there were many times I wondered what I did like that. And I guess I probably stopped. I did all the other times that I can remember. All right, now what happens, though? These individuals, you see it in society, are willing to sacrifice, though, characteristics that God says are very important to get things that corrupt. They're willing to cheat, lie, steal, fudge on their taxes, and do a lot of indecent things. So Christ goes through an example, said, really, your emphasis ought not to be that. So they're important, but if you sacrifice the eternal things that can be built in your life, then you're making a mistake. Now, the Israelites, we're willing to sacrifice all the good things of character in order to get what they wanted. They would get mad, and I mean be so bitter toward Moses, they were ready to kill him in order to get water. So they were willing to sacrifice being the kind of people and thinking like God would like them to have thought in order to get something. It didn't help them out. You've had children do that, haven't you? Willing to sacrifice your nerves and you in order to get something. You know, where they get mad and whine and cry and throw a fit and a tantrum or to get what they want? He told the Pharisees, and these people, these disciples too at this time that he's talking to, in verse 38, he said, "You have heard that it has been said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth." Now that was the way they'd been taught. Now we basically live in an eye for an eye and a tooth for tooth society here. You run into my car, it's your fault, your insurance fixes my fender. Right? That's a fender for a fender. Somebody, you have a swimming pool and somebody falls into it, and a value in this society is placed on the life that's lost, and your insurance company, or you, whatever the case might be, reimburses the person accordingly. You're in a car wreck and get your arm banged up, there's a whole trial involved around paying you for that arm. What is that arm worth? Or what's that tooth worth? There's basically that idea in society. And it's not a bad idea in itself. But Christ went on to say there's something more. He said in verse 39, "And I say unto you that you resist not evil. But whosoever shall smite you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also." Now Christ began saying, "Now I want to tell you there's something else you can do. If somebody hits you on the right cheek, the law says you hit him on the right cheek. You slap him back. That's what you people think." Now that has been turned into undue jokes, ridicule, and funny things. Boy, I'll turn the right cheek, and then I'll turn the left, and then you better watch out. Now what is Christ driving at? What does he mean? How many times in life do you have to practice this? How many times do people come up and hit you on the right cheek? I haven't had that happen since I was a little boy, growing up. You mean Christ wasted all this time telling these grown men something that only children are involved in? You know the way we fight? Let's go on, and you can read through it to get the gist, or gist of it, and find out what it's saying. But what is it? What idea is he implanting? You know the way we hit people on the cheek when we get older? You know, little kids, they come right out and they're violent. I mean, you take their toys, they'll come and slap the other one. The way we hit people on the cheek is verbally, psychologically. A husband comes in and he's been mad all day, you know, and people have done him wrong on his job. And he comes in the door and his wife, you know, is all happy and has dinner ready. And he comes in and says, "Well, what are we having today or tonight?" "We're having chicken," she says. And all happy, and he says, "What do you mean chicken? We have that all the time." And what is he doing to her? He's putting a little bang, slapped her a little bit. Now, most human beings, a wife would say, "Now, hey, wait a minute." She wouldn't take her this long to do it. I'm just rephrasing a little bit of the thought process. You know, I mean, it doesn't come out, it comes out a little faster. I mean, we're good at this. She'd say, "You mean I have spent all day slaving for this guy? He comes in mad as a hornet, saying we have chicken all the time. Here I have very little money to buy groceries with. Doesn't give me much money to buy groceries with, and I slaved away. I burnt my finger. What do you mean we're having chicken tonight?" Then bang. All right, now here's what she said. She did that to him. "Boy, what do you mean yelling at me like that? Don't you know who I am?" "Yeah, I know who you are. You're the guy that did this." What are they doing? They're fighting, right? All right, then. As they fight, then, who turned the cheek? See, when the husband pounded the wife, she turned around and hit him back. Verbally. Then he hit her back. And before long, even the dog is cowering in the corner, scared to death. I mean, the thing knows I'm going to keep out of it. You keep away from these people. You see what happens? This is the way we hit other people. What Christ is saying, there's a whole dimension of life I'm talking about that is different. What if the wife had just said, "I know I ought to tell him I am mad, but I'm going to keep my mouth shut"? Maybe after the guy ate, he would be happy. You know, he'd eat and he'd say, "You know, I had a rough day today. My boss slammed the door of the truck on my finger.
This guy in the back dropped something on my toe. This person came into the shop and yelled at me and threw a crowbar at me and missed me. And I am so mad, I just feel horrible. Maybe it would come out like that. Maybe he'd continue yelling. Christ just said, turn the other cheek. Most of the time, we don't. How about when you go in a restaurant and a waiter or waitress makes a mistake? You know, it's easy not to turn the other cheek. I'm not talking about if somebody you order... we went to a restaurant, and this waitress said these were barbecued beef ribs. And I'll tell you, if what was brought to us was a beef, they got the funniest looking pig someplace I've ever seen. They were spare ribs, you know? Anybody could see that. Now, I'm not talking about saying I'm going to turn the other cheek and I'm going to eat my spare ribs and make that lady happy. You know, but rather than saying and getting up from the table and, you know, throwing them at her, or, you know, stomping them, throwing them off the table, or looking at them and scowling at her, what do you mean bringing these things to me? You know, we said, hey, you know what? What are these? She said, well, they're beef. You know, they don't look like beef to me. And we were nice about it, at least. Because, I mean, anybody that can't tell the difference between a pig and a cow has got problems. Why insult them any further? You know, why make them any sadder? So anyway, you can do that. And oftentimes, if you've seen people rush up and make an accident or do something wrong in traffic, have you ever had anybody just absentmindedly pull out on you? I have. You know, I mean, they just pull right on you, slam on brakes, and they just don't even see you. The reaction is, now they have hit me on the cheek, and man, you blow your horny, what are you doing? And you're riding down the highway mad then because this idiot ran out in front of me, and you blow your horn at other people. All right, you're just going around hitting everybody. And I mean, people look and see you coming, what's that guy blowing his horn at me for? Boy, I'll tell you, that's a nut going along here. And then they start doing it. I mean, we got a whole, you know, you drive in some cities, it's catching like a virus. They need to give a vaccine against it. See what happens? Christ said there's got to be something eternal built in you that just doesn't act that way. It doesn't behave that way. He goes on and says in verse 40, and if any man will sue you at the law and take away your coat, let him have your cloak too. Or also. Now that's not talking about if somebody takes you to court, falling over and saying, you're suing me for this, let me give you all that I have. You know, under even Roman justice and judicial system, if somebody sued you and was awarded your coat, what Christ is saying, it would be better to give him your coat and be nice about it than to go ahead and keep fighting in endless battles. Have you ever seen somebody go through a court trial over a fence line or something? And I mean, the court decides. They go through whatever appeals they can, and the court has decided this. And they spend to their dying day griping about it. Have you ever seen that? You know, somebody has an automobile accident, the insurance company, and they go through court. This is all it is worth. And they say, well, I think it's worth more. And I mean, if you see that person for the next 20 years, he's talking about how he was ripped off. Christ said it's better not to be that way. Once justice has ruled this way, why not go ahead and live your life? And if it might be good if you had the attitude to give him more and just get out of it without worrying about it. You've seen children do that. Argue incessantly over something rather than just saying, all right, we'll settle it. Here it is. My attitude is I'm out of it. And being happy with it. The human proclivity is once you've been taken, once you've gone through the trial, is if you don't get what you thought was yours, to assassinate the other person, to talk about the system, to run it down for the rest of your born days, and make everybody else miserable, including yourself. He's saying, and whosoever shall compel you to go a mile, go with him too. Now back then, if somebody has the authority to compel you to go a mile and could make you do it, he said, you might as well go too. Have you ever had a boss ask you to do something that you didn't want to do? I don't mean anything dishonest or wrong, but in terms of work, and you didn't want to do it. Now, he has, you know, sort of the right to compel you a little bit. So what you do it. You say, well, he wants it done this way, I'll do it this way, blasted. I'll do it. And what you do it in a way that sort of, you know, doesn't do it exactly the best you could. All right, now what are you doing? Have you ever, as a husband or wife, maybe wives are more prone to have this happen, A husband said, we're going to do this, and the wife just plain doesn't want to do it. He's compelled you. So, or maybe the wife says, hey, we got to take the kids over here to do this, and if you use a husband's example, and the husband is compelled to do it. So he goes along in the car, and he gripes the whole way. I told you we shouldn't have come here. See, we're almost out of gas in the car. See, here a car is missing. It's all your fault. What he's doing, instead of going in a happy and sort of a nice way and saying, well, we should go, I ought to go, and I'm going, and I'm going to go the extra mile and be friendly about it, he goes and he gripes and he pulls up and slams, all right, get out and go. See if I care. I'll sit here in the car. You know, he sticks his own like a little child, and, you know, the way we do. And you can see them in parking lots. Take your wife shopping, see these guys sitting out in the car. You know they're mad. I mean, you can tell when people are upset. You just look at it, and it's a marvelous. Go through go around a shopping mall and just view people sometime. And you can tell when a husband has been dragged along. I mean, you can see him. He paces behind. He hides in stores. His wife has to find him. All kinds of things. All right, now that gets down to a very kind of the way we act, doesn't it? See, if somebody compels you to go a mile and they can make you do it, you ought to do it happily. You've got a choice. If they can make you do it, you can either do it miserably or you can do it happily. The human proclivity is when you don't want to do something and you have to be compelled to do it, is to drag your feet. That's my proclivity and your proclivity. What he's saying is it's better not to do that. What I'm talking about Christ is saying is another dimension of life that is so different from the average person it isn't even funny. These things can't be torn down, he's saying. These are the eternal principles that he's talking about that even precede what he was getting to in Matthew chapter 6. Let's look at another example in Matthew 5, verse 21. Let's look at verse 21. Matthew 5, verse 21. To show this dimension of things of what Christ is doing with the mind and God the Father is in giving his Holy Spirit to help us to be something that the Israelites weren't. And it's more important than food and water. Not that they aren't important, but these things are the important principles that underlie the eternal existence of God. And they're very important. Now, he says in Matthew 5, verse 21, you have heard that it was said by them of old, you shall not kill. Now, that was very emphatic. Sixth commandment, don't kill. That's the letter of the law. How many times do you disobey that law? You know, I have never disobeyed the law, thou shalt not kill. I have never killed anybody. You know, we could all give our... if you've been in the military, maybe you've had to under that circumstance. But we could probably, if we were passing out medals for keeping the sixth commandment literally, we could pass out medals to everybody, practically, except those involved in war. And we could all feel righteous, scratch one another's back, and say, boy, isn't this good? We kept that sixth commandment. Christ says, hey, wait a minute. I got something to add to that now. I want to tell you something else about that commandment. He goes ahead and says, and whosoever shall kill shall be in danger of the judgment. But, he said, I say unto you, that whosoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of judgment. Now, if you're angry without a cause, now, if you're angry at anybody, I'll be willing to, I don't guess I shouldn't bet, but I would venture to say, if I'm angry with anybody, I could prove in my own mind that I have a right to be angry. You ever ask a child when they get mad, you know, like two little brothers fighting, you'll ask one of them, why are you fighting? You know, they're mad and angry. Well, he took my toy away from me and I had to hit him. The other one says, well, yeah, he hit me and I had to hit him back. He's going to hit me again. See, they're angry with what they're saying. I've got a cause to be. Well, Christ isn't talking about the Mickey Mouse causes that we sometimes engender. He's talking about something far deeper. He said, there are causes to be angry with something. It's sin and where people are taken advantage of and hurt. That's one thing. But he goes on to express his meaning where you can get a little bit more. He says in the continuing, and whosoever shall say to his brother, Raca. Now, you don't have to be a Greek scholar. Just look in your margin. That means vain fellow. Shall be in danger of the council. Then he goes ahead and says, but whosoever shall say unto you, thou fool. Now look at the margin. It says, graceless wretch. And that pretty well shows what it means. Graceless wretch shall be in danger of hell fire. Now, what is he talking about? Have you ever dealt with people like they're not worth very much? Sure. You know, a lot of things happen in life. Like a vain, worthless fellow. When you get mad at somebody and upset with them, you try to prove, and I do too, it's just a human proclivity, how worthless they are. I remember back home growing up, you know, and probably you've experienced the same thing, families tend to pick on certain members of the, other members of the family. Like our aunts and uncles would pick on another side of the family. Or like my mother would talk about my dad's family. And she'd talk about somebody and, you know, they drink, they do this, they do that. They're no good. And I mean, they'd really get vehement about it. Now, what are they doing? They're saying somebody isn't worth very much. When you tear somebody down and tear them to pieces in bitterness and anger and in a vituperous, bellicose, belligerent, angry, hateful way, what you're doing, you're saying they're not worth very much. You're not treating them with the regard a human being ought to have for another human being. That's what gossip and rumor does. It makes somebody look so black, so bad, so dismal, so no good, that they aren't worth even God's time, much less yours. And this is something we do. Have you ever heard the... I grew up in a religious background. We'd run down other, you know, in the family, they'd run down other religious people. Look at those dumb Pentecostal people. They're no good. Boy, they're brats. They're crazy. And I don't believe that, but I've heard those terms used. This is what it's talking about. Where you view somebody as not worth helping. Now, I want to show you something else. There's more than one way of doing that. Because it also mentions a graceless wretch. Graceless basically means without mercy. And what he's saying is, here are people that look on other people as if they don't deserve any mercy whatsoever. Now, this often happens. When somebody's down and out and, say, feeling horrible, they've done wrong, they feel guilty, they're just sort of getting up off their stomachs, and somebody else comes along and says, look what dirty that person is. Now, what are you doing then? You're saying, now, that person isn't worth my time, my effort, my help, and I'd like to step on him again. Then what's happening to that individual as he tries to get up and all these people come by and they put him down again? They say, yeah, I want to tell you how bad he is. Yeah, you... And you read about that in the paper. You read about people treating one another that way. You see it in the world. Have you ever seen in a job where everybody flogs somebody else to death, picks at them? Say, I want to tell you, that guy, he is nuts. He's no good. Rather than saying, now, he's got problems. How can I help him? The attitude is almost... he's got problems, and I'm going to pick his feet out from under him so he falls a little bit further. Or when somebody is just crawling around in human depravity and discouraged and distraught, I'm not going to help him. Instead of helping him, the proclivity is to tear him down further. Now, what Christ is saying, if you treat people like that, that's not the way he treats people. It's like when old Peter jumped out of the boat and says, Christ, I'm going to run over on the water and grab hold of you. Peter got about halfway over and, you know, glub, glub, glub. He started going down. He said, help me. Some people would have said, Peter, you nuts, you jumped out of that boat. You deserve to drown. Others would have said, now, wait a minute. What I'm going to do, Peter, I'm going to let you know how wrong you were. Just the second before your lungs are so filled with water and you're about to drop to the bottom, I'm going to pick you up. And they had to come over there and dragged him up, pumped the water out of him, said, Peter, I told you, see, you almost died. Need more faith, brother. You know, these are all the attitudes people would have to show these things. You know, Jesus didn't act like that at all. The scriptures don't even show Peter had to go all the way down. Christ went over and just helped him because the guy needed help. And if, you know, he was going to drive him crazy, as Peter went down, Christ didn't let him get all the way down. He picked him up and looked at him, and I think Peter already knew he didn't have any faith. About the time the water got up to his elbows, he, you know, knew something was wrong. He missed something. And Christ said, well, Peter, I've helped you up. You know, you need more faith. Peter, amen. But he didn't let him drown, half drown, three-fourths drown, before he helped him. He got there a little bit sooner. And he helped him because he needed help. And I guess Christ could have looked at Peter and said, you're going to curse, you're going to deny me, and I want to let you know just how bad you are. I'll let you gobble, gobble, gobble till you're about ready to go under. But he didn't do that. Now, this is the way Christ is expressing how he thought about human life. Not only did Christ not murder, He didn't have all those little innuendos and feelings of hatred. He was a man who helped, who was there to help. When the harlot was caught in the case of adultery, I don't think anybody had to go up and say, "Lady, you're in trouble." I mean, she was standing there before a half a dozen or so angry men who had rocks in their hands, ready to kill her. And I don't think Jesus had to come up and say, "Hey, wait a minute, woman, don't kill her, but I want to tell you, woman, how bad you are." That woman was scared to death. That's the reason he didn't have to go. You know, some people use that and say, "Well, look how Christ was so nice." Well, if somebody's about to be shot to death or stoned to death, you don't have to tell them they've been wrong. Their old heart's pounding, their blood pressure's probably 200 over 150. Their veins are about to pop out of their skull. They know they're going to be dead. They've sweated all night. They're worried. Their mind's in absolute turmoil. And these guys standing there ready to kill them, Christ said, "Hey, wait a minute. Let me show what's wrong with these guys." He wrote something. They all left. And he looked at the woman. He said, "I'm not going to condemn you. Just go and don't sin." And what he was implying, if you go and sin, you're going to be back here, and I'm not going to be here next time, maybe. And you know how it feels to be caught. Please, go your way and don't do it anymore. Now, Christ was there to help. He had a tremendous amount of love, which is right the opposite. If you want to put it on a polarity, you can have hatred and murder down here and love way up here. He was in that direction up, not down. Most of us tend to be in the direction these things are talking about, angry without cause and hatred. You worthless wretch. See, we go the opposite way in human life. And Christ is saying, don't deal that way. He said in verse 23, "Therefore, if you bring your gift to the altar, and there remember that your brother has aught against you, leave your gift before the altar, and go your way and first be reconciled to your brother, and then come and offer your gift." Beautiful statement. You know what people will do? If they're mad at somebody else, what do you usually do? Do you go to your brother and say, "Look, I'm upset with you. I don't know what's wrong. I feel bad about it." What you usually do is go tell everybody else, "You know, so-and-so treated me bad. Has he ever treated you bad?"
Yeah.
And you usually go to people you know that think that way. You may not think it in your mind, but boy, we have an innate sense for picking stuff up like that. And you do the same thing. That's what I do. That's the way I think, you know. That's why you sometimes have to think, "Hey, I better not do that." What he's saying is people will do that. Or the other opposite is somebody will go in the prayer closet and say, "God, I have aught against my brother. He treated me dirty. Now, God, you take care of my problems. I want you to show your God and show I'm your son. You go out and get rid of that boss." Boy, I'll tell you, you do my dirty work for me. God said, you better do it yourself. And better not be dirty. It better be to go out and try to reconcile the problem. That happens in marriages, you know, where they get so dismal and bitter and dark to where people begin fighting, and it's a horrible situation to be in. And nobody wants to be reconciled. One is praying, "God, get rid of him or get rid of her," and trying to find people that agree with them. And boy, that's hard to solve. It's almost impossible to solve something in that kind of state. And it's sad because it hurts people. Maybe they need a clean break at times when it gets so bad. Who knows? He says in verse 25, "Agree with your adversary quickly while you are in the way with him." Now that's something most human beings don't do, another dimension. When you're mad at somebody and at adversity with them, how long does it take you to come to see their view and to understand them? See, the human proclivity is not to do that. "Lest at any time your adversary do you in," is what Christ said. "And the adversary deliver you to the judge, and the judge deliver you to the prison, or to the officer, and you be cast into prison." And Christ said, you're going to pay the debt, in verse 26. So the idea is, if God gave you every physical thing you wanted, it would be awfully easy to become spoiled like the Israelites did. However, God is in the business of making sons like him. You can't give somebody goodness. You cannot give somebody the characteristics we, you know, you read here. You can't give somebody joy, peace, and happiness. I well remember up in Toronto about 10, 11, 12 years ago, a guy gave an attack speech on the subject of love, which is an odd thing to give an attack speech on. But I remember it, and I'm glad he did it because it stuck with me. But what he was saying is, you people don't have enough love. You people don't have enough this. And what happened, it was an attack speech. So he brought a newspaper to beat the lectern with. And I sat there, and he was saying, "You ought to have love. Love's what you..." And I thought, now, what's he telling me? He's screaming, "You ought to have love." And I said, now, that's the way to teach somebody to have love, isn't it? To scream at them. Well, no, that's really not the way to do it, is it? It's like parents, you know. Child, you be nice, you be kind. And the parent isn't nice or kind. How does a kid ever learn to be nice or kind? Christ was nice or kind and set the example that we should be like him. He turned the other cheek. Christ dealt with people as if they were worth a lot. They were worth saving and worth helping. Christ showed the example. Those are the valuable things of life. The other things are valuable. But what Christ said in Matthew 6, these things are eternal. Nobody can take them away from you, because if they can, then they're not based on godly principles. Nobody can take the kind of character Christ had away from him. The devil couldn't do it through Judas. The Pharisees couldn't do it through the Romans, and the Romans couldn't take his goodness away from him. And what God had built in him with the Spirit of God, they couldn't take it away from him by driving spikes in his hands and his feet, or by spearing him in the bladder when he was dying. They couldn't take it away from him. He never had that taken away from him. They took away his clothes, his beautiful robe, and he watched them gamble for it. They could do all of that. They could take his physical life. But they never could take what had been built in him as a man who could face trouble, adversity, and turn the other cheek. Who could face people who had done wrong and help them. Not condone them, not pat them on the head and say, go do it more. But I mean help them to where they became better people, where they kept God's laws, where they could have the Spirit of God and the mind of God and the principles of God written in their human minds, where they began to see things on a different vantage point. Nobody could take that away from Christ. Now that's the most valuable gift, frankly, that God can give you or me. The Spirit, to where you have the opportunity to begin to develop that same kind of mind. A mind that'll last forever. Characteristics that cannot be tarnished by pressures of the devil or human beings or whatever. An attitude that is absolutely unparalleled, that would be happy to exist forever in harmony with God. That's the big thing God gives. And yet it's almost a thing nobody ever thinks of. They'd rather have a new car, a new wife, new husband, new teeth, new this, new that, rather than the kind of mind that God is building. That's the important thing God can give. Because that's something that it takes time to build. Bodies, Christ says, they can be built in the moment of the twinkling of an eye. Eternal life can be given like that. But the character that it takes a lifetime to build, where it cannot be tarnished forever, where it's not tarnished in this life, well, that takes our lifetime. With God working in us and His Spirit working in us. And by far, that's the greatest thing that God has given us on a human plane, to learn to be like Him.